I carried so many memories. And I mean, I'm not just an ex-prisoner, I'm also an ex-professional. And over the years, I have seen comrades died in prison, comrades died outside of prison. To me, it was a particularly painful period, but they are comrades who died in the struggle. I travelled to Belfast frequently and on the motorway, and I passed the prison, and I always glance in with a sort of a shiver and done okay. I think of some of the men that died, but I think, of course, of all the others that lived. And there's a certain, I suppose, resilience in the human mind as well, that you have to put things into the back of your mind and move on and look at what's happening today. I think if we don't do that, I think that's one of the great facilities of the human mind, is the ability to forget. I was charged with killing a member of the UDR, the Ultra Defence Regiment. I was held awaiting trial for about 13 months and sentenced in December of 1978. And at that stage, I was then taken to the H blocks in Longcash. When I was taken to the that time it was H Block 3. The protest in Longcash had been underway for a couple of years, and it had reached a fairly developed stage. It had started initially with Kieran Nugent, was the first prisoner to refuse to wear prison uniform, conform to prison rules. By the time I had reached there, the protest had escalated from just purely a refusal to wear prison clothes, which then meant that the only clothes the prisoner had was a prison blanket, hence the name, the blanket protest. It had escalated from simply a blanket protest to become also a dirty protest.
Brought this ball of evidence, which amounted to simple a verbal statement to the fact that I suppose it says okay, I done it, but you never make it stick. This was a verbal statement. It was the only, what they call it, evidence that I would have had, and against this background the judge found me guilty. Everybody was just straight through, just like exactly like a conveyor belt, into charge through the interrogation centres, into remand in the jails, and from the jails into the H blocks, and from the H blocks onto the protest. And that exactly was the line. I followed that line along with hundreds of others.
They would move us from one wing to the next by way of cleaning the cell. And moving from one wing to the other involved men moving naked from one wing to the other. While the search was in progress, the wing shift was in progress, as a man would move naked, prisoner move naked from one wing to the other. Halfway between the wings, the prison authorities then insisted on examining an anal search over, not so much a search, but an anal examination by means of forcing the prisoner to squat over a mirror. Going for a visit, prisoners were frequently subjected to brutal treatment on the way to a visit or back from a visit, because again, men were searched, and these were fairly intimate searches. People were taken and forced to stand naked, raise their arms, turn around, both humiliating, and on occasions violence was used. Men were asked to open their mouths. If they didn't open them wide enough, they would be punched in the head or punched on the body. Different occasions this would happen, and it really depended on the mood and the humour of the prison officers, which in a lot of cases was also dependent on the climate on the outside. I have to be fair that at that time the IRA had a campaign of shooting prison officers being shot. Moreover, the IRA was also engaged in a campaign against the RUC, UGR, British Army, many of whom had relatives on the prison service. We can understand why these men could have been angry, led them to brutality. I mean, I wouldn't for a second deny that they had that there could have been cause for their anger and frustration, but they took their frustrations out on prisoners rather than anybody on the outside.
It was a time just after Ian Neave, I think, was killed. He was killed, of course, by the NLA, my own organisation, which I knew nothing about. In fact, for the day he was killed, the news came in, but it would have filtered down into the blocks, and everybody thought at the time the provost had killed this man. And it was held down there for 30 days, and it was only down 3 or 4 days, and it was brutally beaten by 3 or 4 screws. And I know the names of the screws even this day, and told me about giving a really bad beating. And actually, my blood was everywhere in the cell. I was naked. I mean, I had one blanket, and these 3 screws beat me. For nearly 10 minutes, knocked me out, and had bruises all over my body and all over my testicles too, which I tried to defend, and actually fought back, you know, and I managed to fight back and assault a couple of them as well. But when you're naked, you're very, very scared, of course. But this was another brutal beating, and I thought it was all related to some sort of what they call vengeance for Ian Neave, which I had nothing to do with whatsoever. I didn't even know about whatsoever, you know. However, they got their pound of flesh, so to say. And they thought this would break me, but I stood my ground, and I stayed even though I was isolated and very frightened, young fella, very frightened. I stayed on. So again, all this here was had ingrained itself on my mind. And this was the persistence, you know, and I knew this couldn't go on and on and on.
There was a constant, all-pervasive feeling of tension and fear through the years on the blanket. And in many cases, waiting for violence is much more destructive of the mind than the actual suffering of violence. There is nothing as daunting as listening to cells open one after the other, and to hear someone being beaten in cell 25, 24, 23, 22, 21, you knowing that you're in cell 5 or 6, waiting for the numbers to be counted down, waiting your turn to suffer violence. It's something that tests the nerve of the strongest and the bravest.
Another thing which I remember, it was the beatings, hearing other men getting beating, and you hear a rumble in the cell and the slap of the flesh, and boys shouting out for help, you know what I mean, like maybe 3 or 4 screws beating one man or 2 men, and boys being dragged out of their cells and beating. And I remember looking out through that, we had knocked out small holes in the wall where the door would have made the jam on the wall. We could look out. I remember seeing boys getting beaten out there, you know, and so we were very much full of, you know, vengeance ourselves and hatred for these people, you know what I mean, and vice versa. I mean, I remember one particular incident where a woman prison officer was killed coming out of Armagh jail, where I'm from. And there was 3 or 4 of them coming out during dinner, and was grenades were thrown by an NLA IRA joint operation. And one of them was a woman's kid. I think it was the youngest one, maybe in her late 20s, and 200 or 300. It was a gun and grenade attacked, right on these people coming out of the jail during the dinner break. And when that happened, a lot of the screws came down, and they were saying to me that they were getting revenge and everything else. No, and frightening the hell out of me. You know what? I knew the cunts who'd done it, and I knew these here bastards who'd done it, and I knew these scum who'd done it, and so on. I hadn't a clue. I mean, I was locked up 24 hours a day. I had one visit a month. How God, I would know. But the years went on. 3 years, 4 years, then into nearly our 5th year on the blanket. And we all thought it was going to be over within a year on dirt protests. terrible conditions, you know, land in wintertime, no snow coming through your window and falling on your blanket, been waking up with snow, maggots from the deteriorating and rotten food, which was no kept heat on the corner of the cell. Maggots crawling up and down the mattresses on the floor, crawling into sometimes even under your body, you know what I mean? These were all small maggots which were threw out to the birds and fed. That's one thing we noticed about the birds around at Loncash. We got to know every single bird because we couldn't see anything else. But the deprivation, the sanitary deprivation was a big thing. And we said to ourselves, but how long is this going to go on? What have we to do? We've done everything we could within the jail. We brought it so far, done everything. What are we going to do? And then we realised inevitably be a hunger strike was on the cards.
The first hunger strike began in October. I would have been aware for certainly 2 months before that that I would have been part of the first hunger strike. I remember before it became publicly known that we were going on hunger strike, Brendan Hughes, Bobby Sands talked to me about it. I actually was on the wing with Brendan Hughes. Brendan was the IRA commanding officer in the prison. Bobby Sands, I think perhaps was his deputy. Bobby was also on the wing with me, and Brendan McFarland, and I can't remember, Brendan was also one of the senior people, and I remember the three of those would have spoken with me about the upcoming hunger strike, and I would have been aware of it before the public would have known about it. I believe we all realised that it was a situation that couldn't continue. And I remember on occasions going through wing searches, beaten up through moves, wing moves, sitting hours naked in a cell without any bedding or anything in cells, saying that this is a situation that just cannot continue indefinitely as this. We either have to surrender or fight. And I think that had eventually dawned on many of us. It certainly had dawned on me. And when it come around, there was a certain... there was a huge responsibility. It was frightening, but it was also a relief in the sense that we were forcing the situation towards a climax, that we were no longer sitting passively. Ominous to a certain extent. The prison guards come around, and unlike their usual nasty, abrasive treatment as they delivered the breakfast, they had been instructed very carefully to get the name and the prison number of the prisoner refusing food, because they were not sure which of us were refusing was going to go on the hunger strike. The wing I was on, two of us were out to go on hunger strike, Brendan Hughes and myself. And I remember the prison officers, unlike other times when they come round bawdy and bawling, I could hear them opening Brendan Hughes' cell and very, very courteously asking, "Are you sure you're not taking food? Can we confirm that?" To me, it seemed very, very strange to hear them speak so civilly. And eventually they come round to my cell. And again, I said, "No, I'm on hunger strike. I'm refusing food." And rather than what was their usual disdainful, sarcastic manner, it wasn't so much respectful, but as total concentration, because they had been instructed. It was very important to get the names of the hunger strikers. And they asked me to confirm that. And I said, "Yes, I'm on hunger strike." And away they went. They actually left my breakfast, which I didn't touch, and that was the start for me of the hunger strike, first meal refused. And what the prison officers would do would be, they would leave the breakfast, it would stay there until dinner time, they would then come in, they would take the breakfast and they would leave the dinner, they would then come back at tea time, they would take the dinner, leave the tea, and then at supper time they would come in and they would take the tea and leave the supper. And it was there overnight. The supper remained in the cell overnight until the next morning when the cycle started again. The last previous day's supper was taken away and the breakfast, the next day's breakfast, left in its place. And that continued throughout the 53 days I was in hunger strike. I had heard people say that after a few days in hunger strike, one's appetite goes. It wasn't my experience. I was hungry for about 44 or 45 days. And after 10 days in the cell, I was moved then to what was known as a special wing in the H blocks, which was clean in bed. We had beds, we had blankets, we were given pajamas. And I was there. I was also then allowed reading material for the first time in a couple of years. I had magazines and newspapers. And for the next, say, 30 days, it seemed to be every time I opened a newspaper, I could see ads for fish and chips, burgers, potatoes, and I could see the most marvellous cookery sections. I never read cookery recipes. I never had, and I haven't since. But I took a fascination for reading cookery recipes. But my experience was that the hunger remained for about 44, 45 days. Now, it wasn't that the hunger magically disappears. My health dramatically deteriorated after 45 days. All the different bodily functions basically just collapsed. And at that stage, instead of being hungry, I was feverish. I was vomiting. My kidneys were in a process of failure. The enzymes were building in my stomach. I was duodenal bleeding and poisoning. It was a fairly nasty situation. But rather than being hungry, I was just sick.
I remember lucidly lying on a mat, on a piece of sponge on the floor with the blankets on me and trying to keep warm. It was cold. And the first week was really bad, and that you felt your stomach caving in. I could actually hear my stomach at night. It kept me awake. All this rumbling within my stomach and the whole sort of my insides, my intestines adjusting to being deprived of food essentials, being deprived of the very essence of their survival, food, and trying to come to terms with this all in my mind, that here was my mind was starving my body, and my body was going into survival mode. Do you understand? I remember when I was thinking to myself, how were people getting on with it? Were they making love? But outside, there was this here. There was always this surreal aspect or dimension to the whole thing, where life was going on just outside the walls. Screws were coming in talking about Christmas. The prison officers, the medical officers were coming about doing their daily chores in a very functional way. They come in, they'd wash us. They would, for example, place the fleeces. These were sheepskin fleeces under our bodies to stop our bones breaking through the skin. They would grease the different joints of our body so the bones wouldn't break through the skin again. We had the priests in. We had members of our family coming in. And yet, all this here, sort of what they call it, a ray of life, and which was taking place all around us. And yet here we were, still continuing today. I wasn't a devout person in terms of religion, but I remember praying to God, to try and help me through this here. I wouldn't have been overtly religious in any way, you understand? But I felt that the power of not so much with prayer and contemplation, and again with political motivation to try to keep me on. But I mean, every day you were coming towards the end, you were conscious of that fact, you were coming towards the end, you're coming to that threshold when you're going to have to make a decision. Someone's going to say to you, look, 48 hours and you're out, you're away, you're going to be in the cell, you're going to be buried in the cell, you're going to be buried in the graveyard, and they're going to be flowers in your grave for Christmas. You're not seeing Christmas. This is December, 1980. And you were trying to come to terms with this here aspect of it, of envisioning yourself. I used to sit down and maybe envision my own funeral, envision myself, my own coffin, and see myself in in a room in my home in Drumarg, in Armagh, and people coming in, and I used to dwell on these things. They were terribly morbid, but they couldn't help it because this was reality he was facing.
We didn't know what to expect altogether, what to expect. And some of the tales we had told, that, as I said to you, people telling me that you lose your appetite, I didn't. Some of the things that did happen, for some reason, my senses seemed to intensify. My sense of smell seemed to magnify. I could smell, at one stage, I could smell the paint on the chairs. Totally incredible, in the sense that you might smell the paint on a chair for an hour or two after it would be freshly painted. But these were chairs, well-worn chairs. I could smell the paint on the chairs. I could smell disinfectant that was at the end of the corridor.
The first thing you smell is your breath coming back up. It's rotten. Your insides are rotten. Your anus closes up. There's no more excrement coming out. You understand? And your bowels your bowels are tightening up too, right? Your stomach is shrinking. There's a smell exuding from your body. This smell, I always remember, and I used to always sort of equate it with the smell awake, of a dead body. You know, the smell of rotting flesh. Because, I mean, what's happening? You're dying. You're starving your body. And you're in the process of dying. Even though you're still alive, you know, very much, and you want to live. Being compelled to carry on, dying for whatever the reason may be, you understand? And so on. And the fear.
Until eventually, I suppose towards the very end, I was drifting in and out of consciousness. I was having hallucinations on occasions. I remember at one stage thinking that I could hear in the distance somebody playing a Kili music. I thought it went on for hours, and I thought at one stage that it was being done deliberately to aggravate me, until I eventually found out a few days after the hunger strike that there wasn't Kili music within miles of where I was, that it was some trick of the mind. I suppose by that stage, not maybe all that hard to explain. The body is a fantastically sophisticated machine, and nature provides that with the deprivation of food, the body starts to use up the least vital of its assets, first the fat and then the muscle and then the bone marrow, and eventually it works its way through to the organs of the body, kidneys, liver, pancreas. Eventually the heart and brain are the last two organs to go, and on some occasions that has almost happened in that sequence. The problem, of course, is that occasionally that the process can be short-circuited, that the body deteriorates rapidly. In my case, what was happening was my kidneys started to fail. Because my kidneys were failing, my body was incapable of clearing the poison, and as the poison built up, then instead of it being discharged normally, it was recirculated through the bloodstream, and so it meant that my body was being poisoned from top to bottom. This caused headaches. It caused me to have pins and needles sensation in the tips of my fingers and toes, and gradually that sensation started to travel up through my body from the fingertips into my hands and then towards the elbows and from my toes to my ankles and so on. And the other thing, of course, was that I started to vomit. The bowels and the enzymes and whatever is normally produced by the intestines, which eventually then started to tear at the walls of the intestines and caused the intestines to bleed. So I was vomiting blood and bile. And at that stage, basically, I was in fairly enormous pain. It's a very difficult process. As I say, the hallucinations, the unconsciousness, the routine pain-racked experience. And that was coming towards the end. The hunger strike ended on the 18th of December. I think it was a Friday. I think it was about 6 or 6:30 on the Friday evening. I was in a drifting between consciousness and unconsciousness, and the other five hunger strikers were still conscious and lucid. So they gathered around Brenton to hear of the decision, and the five of them talked it over, and Brenton told them of his decision, told them of the reasons for his decision, and they continued to talk about it, and chaplains started to arrive and different things, and they talked and they talked and they talked, and nobody thought to tell me for I think maybe 2 hours that the hunger strike was over. And I remember the prison medics coming in to me and asking me to take some medicine, and I said, no, we're still on hunger strike. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, I think we'll have to send for Brenton. And I remember the Brenton coming into the ward to me. And I, at that stage, because the light was so painful on my senses that I had the lights turned off. I remember lying in the bed with my hand across my one good eye. One eye was blind, the other was, I could just see through vaguely, and I had to close it to keep the light out. And I remember just on the sort of the peripheral vision seeing Brenton, and I knew the figure so well, and of course I knew the voice saying it's over. It's ended a couple of hours ago, come off. And I said, that's it, fair enough, if Brenton says it. But that for me, it had ended then, and there was a... immediately we started to receive medical treatment, injections, a few injections, and believe it or not, the doctor then prescribed not any type of drip feed or high protein. Believe it or not, he prescribed scrambled egg.
I remember that very poignantly, and he said, "Actually, we have here, we've got something here, a solution here. We're going to call this off." This was on a Thursday, you know, on a Thursday on the 18th of December 1980. And I remember that night very well, and remember how it was broadcast on downtown radio within hours. You know, people were waiting on the news, what's happening? There was so much a big euphoric, very euphoric time, you understand? And a very, electric atmosphere outside and inside the jail. And our people coming in and visiting us more. I actually had the first visit from my brother, who was also in jail. I hadn't seen him for years and years, and they brought him up from the compounds to the prison, to the hospital, to visit me. He hadn't seen me for years. He didn't even recognise me. I was just a wraith, and with a massive beard, and I was like a sort of, what do you call it? Someone says, and now looking out of a navy board. You know, you can hardly see my face. I shrunk that much, and this here massive beard, something like a bit like Rasputin maybe, after he was dead. You understand? But in Brenton, he's called off, and I realised the whole serious nature of the thing, and the decision he had made, and I supported him in that decision at the time. And I realised that we had a solution. If Brenton had read the document, others had read the document, and we knew that there was a potential for a really good, to get this whole thing resolved without any further life being lost, either inside the jail or outside the jail. And that's how it ended, that hunger strike. And the rest, as you know, is history. It was not implemented. It wasn't, the thing was not imposed or implemented in any way. But they tried to, but it fell very, very short. It was we were very much shortchanged, big time. We were shortchanged big time. First of all, we had been cooped up for almost 5 years in a cell, 24 hours a day. We had lived on bits of we had lived and slept on pieces of sponges on the floor. There's nothing in the cell. I mean, try to envisage or evoke the images of the hunger strike, not the hunger strike, of the blanket protest at that time, as they were portrayed across the world and throughout in the world media. You've seen stark empty cells, bearded Rasputin type figures standing in corners with blankets around them against windows, and all you had was a piss pot or a water gallon on the floor and two pieces of sponge, and each man had three rough prison blankets around them. So let us out onto the yards, and we had men walking more than 9 steps for the first time. I mean, it was your cell is 9 feet long, and you had maybe 6 steps back. When men tried to walk, they could walk slowly, and they had to sort of what they called adjust, physically adjust themselves to the new environment straight away, immediately. There and then, and men would walk slowly, but other boys actually thought it was a matter of coming out and taking up the sort of behaviour, physical behaviour, as it had been before they went on, and they tried to run. They ran about 10 yards and they crept over. They tumbled over like tumbler pigeons in the air when he made on the ground, because their bodies had not been used to walking a sustained distance. They'd been so confined, cooped up like chickens in a hatchery. And as you know, when you like, if you let chickens out of a hatchery, then they're inclined to run up against all the wires. I remember one particular, they tried to play a game of football. And this was a novelty. Having a game of football was something like, you need to show them by giving their freedom. When they put a ball in the yard, I haven't seen a ball for many years. Someone spent 5 years in a blanket. And then they were kicked a ball, a run. And men were falling about like 10-pin bowls all over the yard. Boys shaved for the first time in years, right? Everybody had big beards, right? We only seen each other at mass once a week, if we were lucky. Everybody had to go to mass. And everybody had long hair, big beards. And the first thing a lot of them done was to get it shaved off. Right, so we were still locked up in the cells at the time, and the boys were left their cells and went up and got their beards all shaved off and their hair trimmed down. And then we all met out in the yard, and nobody knew each other. We said, "Who are you?" And the rat looked very intently and keenly to try and see who this person was. I mean, half their faces, all you seen was maybe from their cheeks up to the eyes. Can you imagine? Yeah, something like 300 men getting all that shaved off and then seeing each other for the first time. We didn't know each other. Who are you? It was an awful shock. And you'd be sitting beside somebody and sort of the fellow says, "Well, I'm Joe Dougherty, or I'm what they call it, Shinna Walsh, or I'm Martin Walsh, or whatever." Jesus Christ. The only time we seen the sky was once a month when we went on a visit, but we never, most, that was once, and maybe for a period of 3 minutes. 3 minutes down the visit, 3 minutes back. And I remember men saying, I was trying to describe how, when they did, eventually were able to look at the sky for a prolonged period of time, more than 3 minutes that is. The sky seemed to be running away from them, like into a sort of what they called a point. Some point in the distance, or some sort of point. And we couldn't see the horizon, obviously, because it was a 20-foot fence around us. It's like walking around the inside of a biscuit tin. Men described the sensation of seeing the sky as if it was running away into a sort of, what do you call it, a telescope. A telescopic point somewhere in the distance. But at the time we were dying, the doctor, Dr. Ross, who was a prison doctor, I remember him well coming in. First of all, the doctor would come in with an MO, and the MO would explain to you the process of hunger strike and how that was going to impact upon your body. And he said there was a whole period of deterioration. A process was taking place right now. This MS with the MO in our cell, I'd be sitting there with a blanket around me, big massive beard and so on, and I was in hunger strike, and my food was at the door. You understand? And this MO was a medical officer would come in and say, "Do you realise the gravity of your decision. Do you understand what you're doing? Do you understand what's going to happen? Do you understand the process? And then he would relay to me what that process was. And it would be backed up and confirmed by the doctor in the presence of a chief or maybe an assistant governor and so on. I said at the time I did understand it, but I mean, obviously I didn't. I was well below par when I came into jail, well below par. And then when I hit 30s, I realised I started to go down. And especially then, that was a slow deterioration, you know what I mean, a slow sort of going down. And then when I hit 40, I went down. I remember, I could actually remember, I can feel my whole physical strength and all, like, you know, I just wasn't up to it. I knew there was something was kicking in here. And I realised, you know, I'd done a bit of research on it too, and I realised that all I went through, the shootings, I mean, I had my stomach blew out. I held my guts in my hand, my balls in my hand, and I could see my tea that I had that night. I remember it well. It was a salad I had, and it was only half digested, and I could see the lettuce, and it was the smell of the half-formed excrement, and the smell of burning blood, of course. And the smell of burning flesh, and the smell of terrible, as my mate's burnt blood. But I went through all that there, and I said to myself, my God, you know, it's bound to impact me. It has to kick in sometime. And it did. And, you know, the doctor's words always rang back. His words have a clarity, an unwanted clarity about them today. When I feel like, I am not fit for money and work now. Now, if I went out and worked in the building, I'd be killed. And that's been quite a long time, you know. And now I'm 45 years of age, I'm now coming and hitting middle age, so to say, you know. And I know for a fact that what has helped me in the past, especially during the hunger strike, has impacted upon me in a big way. I've no doubt about that. Especially past 3 years. No, 5 years, sorry. I'm now 45. But it's a tough way. Downward trend, big time.
I found it a very, very difficult, horribly traumatic experience to watch those men on hunger strike. One, there was a feeling that we had failed them because our hunger strike hadn't achieved what we thought we had achieved, and that we were saying those men are now having to do what we failed to do. There was that sense. Secondly, we knew very, very acutely the pain and the agony they were going through. Even now, 20 years later, it remains one of the most traumatic periods of my life. And I've had some traumatic days over my life. As a matter of record, my three brothers died in the course of the Troubles, and while each death traumatised me greatly, it didn't have the same protracted traumatic effect on me that the hunger strike period did. The knowledge of it has seared itself into my consciousness. And when you talk about books, Normally, Server Time, 10 Men Dead, I have never read one of those books, and I don't imagine that I ever will, because I don't imagine that I ever could. I can read about the ambush on Lagal, where my brother was shot. I don't like it. It certainly doesn't. It's not anything that I take with any great relish, but I have read the accounts of the inquests and the events and that. But I've never read the inquests or the story of the hunger strikes, because I just feel it too painful. And still, it's 20 years later, still doing. I don't envisage that particular situation changing greatly for the next 20 years if I live that long. Men on the wing, the men lived with me on the wing. We were together 24 hours a day. We spent endless hours talking. And on the wing with me for the last sort of, certainly 18 months of their lives, Bobby Sands, Tom McElwee, Kevin Lynch, Martin Hurston, and we talked, we all of us talked on that wing, not just those men, but we all of us talked. We talked endlessly. Times we talked about politics, we were young men. Times we talked about football, we talked about the dances we had attended, the girls we had known, the schools we'd been to, the things, all of those things, some of them intellectual, bulk of them trivial, that people together of the same age, young men together, talk about the concerns we had. The bulk of them are irrelevant in many ways. And we talked about the passions of politics, and we talked of our ideas and our thoughts and our hopes. And we spent endless hours consoling one another after a brutal treatment. And we tried to talk each other's courage up again, and then to see them taken away from us. It was in many ways like losing family members, members of a family. The old ex-blanket men, and so many of us have greatly different opinions, but there still remains an area that we can contact each other. I know for many years after, within the prison, there was a stamp on a blanket man that was long after the blanket had ended, and no matter how bitter the disagreements were, that there was almost a feeling, it was almost like watching a wolf pack come together, that whenever we moved into wings together, and over the years new people come into the prison and men went out, but invariably you could see the old blanket men almost like a wolf pack, the instinct to group together, to herd together, because they felt almost so comfortable in each other's company. And so it was so traumatic when the boys died, as they died slowly. As I say, it hasn't, in some ways it hasn't eased greatly, that memory or the pain over the years.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.